Hello, I'm Suzanne Green, an Associate Director of Neutral Management at FINRA Dispute Resolution. Welcome and thank you for listening to this Neutral Workshop. I'm pleased to introduce our FINRA speakers, Linda Feinberg, President, FINRA Dispute Resolution, and Margot Hassan, Assistant Chief Counsel in Dispute Resolution. During this workshop, Margot will provide us with an overview of the revisions to the Discovery Guide effective May 16th, and then Linda will discuss another recent rule change. Margot will begin by explaining why FINRA uses a discovery guide, and then will provide updates on the revisions to the guide.
Over the years, FINRA found that discovery disputes in customer arbitration cases were becoming more numerous and time-consuming, and that the same discovery issues repeatedly arose. So in 1999, FINRA adopted the discovery guide, which includes the document production list for arbitration cases involving customer disputes with firms and associated persons. FINRA designed the discovery guide to provide direction on which documents parties should exchange without arbitrator or staff intervention. After years of experience with the discovery guide, FINRA reviewed the guide for the purpose of updating it. FINRA staff worked closely with a FINRA advisory committee, the National Arbitration and Mediation Committee, called the NEMC, to revise the discovery guide. The NEMC is made up of attorneys who represent investors, representatives of brokerage firms, arbitrators, and mediators. The majority of its members are public. In addition, FINRA staff met with other frequent users of the forum, representing both the public and the industry, to listen to the concerns of each side about the document production lists, their proposals for changes, and their reactions to other constituents' proposals. In 2010, FINRA filed for SEC approval of the new revised discovery guide. The SEC recently approved the new guide, and it is effective for all cases filed on or after May 16, 2011. FINRA will shortly establish a discovery task force under the auspices of the NEMC. The task force will review substantive issues relating to the discovery guide on an ongoing basis, with an eye towards keeping the discovery guide current as products change and new discovery issues arise. At the request of FINRA constituents, first on the task force's agenda will be a review of issues relating to electronic discovery, or e-discovery.
Margot, thanks for sharing some background information about the discovery guide. Will you please walk us through the changes?
In the revised discovery guide, FINRA expands the guidance to parties and arbitrators on the discovery process and updates the document production lists. As you know, the old discovery guide contained 14 lists, two general lists, and 12 separate lists for specific types of claims, like claims alleging unauthorized trading or failure to supervise. In the revised discovery guide, FINRA replaced the 14 lists with two lists of presumptively discoverable documents, one for firms and associated persons to produce and one for customers to produce. FINRA consolidated the lists in response to investor representatives' suggestions that we eliminate the lists for specific types of claims because customers are not required to plead causes of action under the customer code. FINRA incorporated many of the documents from the old lists into the revised discovery guide and is requiring parties to produce additional types of documents that forum users indicated they need to fully develop their cases. Although each item on the document production lists, with a few exceptions, is presumptively discoverable in every customer case, the revised discovery guide encourages arbitrators to tailor discovery to the facts and circumstances of each case. And I can't emphasize enough how important that point is. The revised discovery guide encourages arbitrators to tailor discovery to the facts and circumstances of each case. Now that there are only two document production lists, FINRA is relying on you to use your professional judgment when deciding contested issues about document production.
Okay, Margot, so before you get into the specifics about the new discovery guide, will you please take a few minutes and talk about the discovery process in general?
Of course. As an arbitrator, it is up to you to keep the discovery process on track, and that includes encouraging parties to enter into stipulations, to agree to the joint submission of pre-marked exhibits, and to narrow the issues in dispute. In addition, you should consider whether briefs or legal memoranda on an issue would be helpful to the panel, and if you decide that they would be helpful, you should establish a schedule for their submission, set deadlines and issue orders that will expedite the discovery process and permit each party to develop its case fully. As an arbitrator, you have the power to enforce your discovery decisions. You may issue sanctions against any party for failing to comply with the discovery provisions of the rules, unless you determine, that there is substantial justification for the failure to comply. You may also issue sanctions to a party for frivolously objecting to the production of requested documents or information. In addition, the arbitrators may dismiss a claim, defense, or arbitration case with prejudice as a sanction for the material and intentional failure to comply with an order of the panel if prior warnings or sanctions have proven ineffective. If you'd like to learn more about dealing with discovery abuse and issuing sanctions, you can take FINRA's online course titled Discovery, Abuse, and Sanctions 2011. This course focuses on the respective duties of arbitrators and parties in the discovery process and discusses the need for orders of confidentiality, guides arbitrators to recognize and address discovery abuses, and reviews the array of possible sanctions if they become necessary. The course takes approximately 1 hour to complete.
Margo, thanks for highlighting the changes to the discovery guide and providing important general information about managing discovery. Will you now share the details of the revisions to the guide?
Well, let me start with the introductory text. FINRA greatly expanded the introduction in the discovery guide to give parties and arbitrators more guidance on the discovery process generally and to clarify how arbitrators should apply the guide in arbitration cases. The introduction addresses a number of important points, and I'd like to walk through some of them. Let's start with flexibility, because I can't emphasize enough how important this point is. You and the parties retain flexibility in the discovery process. As an arbitrator, you can order the production of documents not provided for by the lists. You can order the parties do not have to produce certain documents on the list in a particular case, and you can alter the production schedule. When you're deciding discovery issues, keep in mind that production of documents in discovery does not create a presumption that the documents are admissible at a hearing. The parties will have the opportunity to object to the introduction of any document as evidence at a hearing to the same extent that they can raise any other objection. To further reiterate that arbitrators must be flexible when applying the discovery guide, the revised guide points out that parties and arbitrators should recognize that not all firms have the same business model, and certain items on the document production lists for firms and associated persons may not apply to a particular case when the business model is considered. For example, depending on the facts of a case, the issues that arise between a full-service firm and its customers may not be the same as the issues that arise between a discount broker and its customers. Therefore, you may determine that certain documents do not have to be produced in a particular case, or that additional documents should be produced. Similarly, certain items on the customer document production list may not apply to a particular case depending on the claims the customer asserts. Now let's turn to objections based on cost or burden of production. The introduction now includes guidance on what you should do when a party objects to producing a document on the list because of the cost or burden of production. If a party demonstrates that the cost or burden of production is disproportionate to the need for the document, you should determine if the document is relevant or likely to lead to relevant evidence. If you do reach the conclusion that is relevant or may lead to relevant evidence, you should consider whether there are alternatives that can lessen the impact, such as narrowing the time frame or scope of an item on the document production list, or determining whether a different document can provide the same information. As I stated earlier, you are empowered to order the production of documents not provided for by the document production list. And when you're considering a request for additional documents, you must use your judgment to determine whether you should order a party to produce the requested documents. You may not deny document requests solely on the ground that the documents are not expressly listed in the discovery guide. The revised discovery guide makes it clear that only named parties must produce documents pursuant to the discovery guide. However, non-parties may be required to produce documents pursuant to an arbitrator's subpoena. Under the customer code, arbitrators may order the appearance of any employee or associated person of a FINRA member or the production of any documents in the possession or control of these individuals. While only named parties are required to produce documents pursuant to the discovery guide, the arbitrators may use the document production list as guidance for discovery issues that involve non-parties. Also new in the discovery guide is language addressing electronic documents. The revised discovery guide expressly states FINRA's position that electronic files are documents within the meaning of the guide, and that arbitrators decide disputes that arise concerning the form in which a document will be produced. As I mentioned earlier, FINRA intends to ask the discovery task force to consider e-discovery issues.
The confidentiality is a big concern in discovery matters. How does the new guide help?
The revised discovery guide helps by expanding the guidance FINRA gives arbitrators on this important topic. If a party objects to document production citing grounds of privacy or confidentiality, you may suggest a stipulation between the parties that the documents in question will not be disclosed or used in any manner outside of the arbitration of the particular case. You may also issue a confidentiality order. When deciding contested requests for confidentiality orders, you should consider the competing interests of the parties. The party asserting confidentiality has the burden of establishing that the disputed documents require confidential treatment. You should take into account the facts of the case and consider the factors specified in the revised discovery guide, including, among others, whether discovery would constitute an unwarranted invasion of personal privacy, such as disclosing a party's social security number or medical information, or whether the information contains a firm's proprietary confidential business plans and procedures or trade secrets. Several commenters on FINRA's proposed rule change were concerned that the discovery guide might require production of privileged documents, so FINRA expanded guidance on this topic as well. The discovery guide expressly states that parties are not required to produce documents that are otherwise subject to an established privilege, including the attorney-client privilege and the work product doctrine, and arbitrators may not issue an order or use a confidentiality agreement to require parties to produce privileged documents. Now let's switch gears and move on to the last topic I'm going to talk about concerning the guide's introduction, affirmations when a party asserts that there aren't any responsive documents. If a party indicates that there are no responsive documents in the party's possession, custody, or control, the customer or the appropriate person in the brokerage firm who has knowledge must, upon the request of the party seeking the documents, 1, state in writing that the party conducted a good faith search for the documents, 2, describe the extent of the search, and 3, state that, based on the search, there are no requested documents in the party's possession, custody, or control. When appropriate, you may order a party to provide affirmations relating to discovery requests for documents beyond those listed in the discovery guide. In addition, the discovery guide also states that parties are not required to create documents in response to items on the list.
Well, that's a lot of changes in the introduction. What do arbitrators need to know about the two document production lists?
Indeed, that was an extensive revision. I've been talking for a long time, so I'm going to keep my remarks on the document production lists brief. Document production list 1 specifies the presumptively discoverable documents that firms and associated persons are required to produce in customer cases. Document production list 2 specifies the presumptively discoverable documents that customer parties are required to produce. Subject to limited exceptions specified in certain lists and to the flexibility I stressed earlier, the parties are required to produce every document in every case. The document production list include most of the documents that were included in the old discovery guide. FINRA added clarity to a number of the old items on the document production list and added new items that forum users indicated they need to fully develop their cases. Most items include timeframes for the scope of document production. While FINRA carefully crafted these timeframes after numerous discussions with its constituents, the timeframes, like the documents on the list themselves, can be altered depending on the facts of the case. I can't emphasize enough that you are empowered to use your judgment to ensure that the parties get the documents they need and that the case moves forward efficiently. As you've been hearing, the revised discovery guide contains extensive information to help you make the discovery process effective and efficient. We urge you to read the entire discovery guide, which you can find as a link above the audio file to this workshop, as well as a link to Regulatory Notice Number 2011-17.
Margo, thanks for sharing this very valuable information about the revised discovery guide. Now, Linda will discuss one of our most significant rule changes since we instituted the neutral list selection system.
Thank you, Suzanne. As you all know, on February 1st of this year, FINRA amended its rules on how parties choose their arbitration panels. This is a significant change, offering more paneling options for the parties. I will explain the new option in detail, but first I want to provide some background information. Prior to the rule change, for all investor claims of more than $100,000, the rules provided for a 3-arbitrator panel, comprised of a chair-qualified public arbitrator, a second public arbitrator, and a non-public arbitrator. In contrast to the public arbitrator, the non-public arbitrator, often referred to as an industry arbitrator, may have ties to the securities industry. The arbitrator may, for example, be employed by a brokerage firm, or may be a professional who devotes a significant portion of time to securities industry clients. And of course, in cases where the claim is under $100,000, that case is paneled with a single public arbitrator. Over the years, investor advocates have argued that the inclusion of an arbitrator with ties to the industry raises a perception of unfairness to investors. FINRA does not believe that industry arbitrators are unfair to investors, and independent research confirms that industry arbitrators are not biased. Nevertheless, to address the perception of unfairness, FINRA amended its rules to allow investors with three arbitrators on their panel to choose between two panel composition methods. The first method, called the composition rules for majority public panel, is the method parties used to select arbitration panels prior to the rule amendments. As I stated a moment ago, it provides for a panel of three arbitrators with one having connections to the industry. The second method, which is new, called the composition rules for optional all-public panel, if selected by the investor, allows any party to choose an all-public arbitration panel. The new rule applies whether the investor is a claimant or a respondent. Thus, investors now have the option of having their cases heard by arbitrators with no connection to the securities industry. Under the rule amendments, only investors may choose the method for composing the arbitration panel. And the new rules apply only to investor cases. They do not apply to cases with only industry parties. FINRA gives 30 investors 35 days to pick the panel composition method. If investors don't make a selection, FINRA proceeds as though they picked the majority public panel option. Once the investor chooses the method for selecting the arbitration panel, all parties participate in the arbitrator selection process. Each party receives randomly generated computer lists of potential arbitrators, together with the arbitrator disclosure reports for the listed arbitrators. Under both panel composition methods, FINRA sends the parties three arbitrator lists of 10 names each, a list of public arbitrators who are chair qualified, a second list of public arbitrators, and a list of non-public arbitrators. Each party is permitted to strike up to four arbitrators from the chair and the public lists, leaving at least six arbitrator names remaining on each party's list. However, the process for striking arbitrators from the non-public list differs based on the panel composition method used. For example, under the majority public panel method, each separately represented party may strike up to four arbitrators on the non-public list. FINRA will appoint the highest-ranked available non-public arbitrator from the combined rankings. And in cases in which the parties strike all of the arbitrators appearing on the non-public list, FINRA will appoint a non-public arbitrator selected randomly by computer. Under the new method, the all-public panel method, each party has unlimited strikes with respect to the non-public list. FINRA will not appoint a non-public arbitrator if the parties, either individually or collectively, strike all the arbitrators appearing on the non-public list. Instead, FINRA will appoint a a non-public arbitrator, resulting in an all-public panel.
So, Linda, what does this mean for the role of the non-public arbitrator?
I cannot emphasize enough that there is still a very important role for industry arbitrators in the FINRA forum. First, the proposed rule does not apply to arbitration disputes involving only industry parties. And these cases constitute anywhere from 25 to 35% of the claims filed in our forum each year. Second, the statistics from the Public Arbitrator Pilot Program that ran from October 2008 through January 2011 demonstrate that many investor claimants will continue to choose a non-public arbitrator on their panel. You can find these data on our website. Now I will turn the call back to Suzanne for some final remarks.
Well, thank you, Linda. As a reminder, links to all the reference material that Linda and Margot mentioned are available above the link to this audio file. Unlike many of our other neutral workshops, which are largely informational, the purpose of this workshop is to provide training to our neutrals on the revised discovery guide. Therefore, if you would like to receive training credit on your arbitrator disclosure report for this neutral workshop, please listen carefully. Send an email to FINRA, DRNM, at FINRA.org. Again, it's FINRA, DRNM, at FINRA.org. Make sure your subject line reads Discovery Guide Workshop, and in the body of your email, include your neutral ID and your first and last name. Within a reasonable time after receipt of your email, FINRA staff will manually update the training section of your arbitrator disclosure report to include reference to this workshop. This takes time, so we appreciate your patience. On our next neutral workshop, we will review anti-money laundering requirements. We will focus on the confidentiality of suspicious activity reports called SARs, disclosure of an existing SAR, and when a SAR issue may arise in an arbitration. If you have any additional questions about this workshop, please send them to FINRA DR Call-In Workshop. There's a link to this mailbox right above the link for the audio recording. Thank you for listening.